Hello and welcome to episode 19 of the End of Seeking podcast with myself, Martin.
And me, Imogen.
It's autumn here in coastal Wales. We're sitting at the table with a cup of hot chocolate.
A joy of life.
Yeah, the seasons are changing, aren't they? They have kind of changed, but they're still quite mild. The wind, a bit of rain.
The sweaters and the scarves have come out. I kind of like this season. It's one of my favourites, actually.
It's a turning within season, isn't it? Mm. It's that beginning of turning in within, gathering oneself in a cosy, warm place.
Yeah.
And it naturally wants to turn the mind and heart back in.
Yeah, there's a sense of retreat in it, a sense of softening, and a sense of coming to a place of rest.
Yeah.
And in that, that's where the rejuvenation happens for the spring.
Yeah.
It's actually a pretty perfect segue.
Into what?
Into... a question that came up in my satsang on the weekend.
Okay.
A request to talk about something that I've labeled as, and many have, I'm sure.
We've labeled it, haven't we? Yeah.
Yeah. The doldrums.
The doldrums. We had a very extended doldrums.
Yeah. And this is specifically post-awakening, the doldrums. And just to give context to what that means to those that maybe don't know what that means. Actually, I don't know where it
The doldrums comes from. is a nautical term.
Yes.
For you're sailing and you find yourself in a region of ocean and there's no current, there's no wind, it's pleasant weather. It's nice.
Right around the equator, isn't it?
Yeah. I guess it's a place, but it's also characterized as a certain way of
a state.
Being at sea, where you're in the days of sail, you relied on winds, you relied on currents. And so when those were absent, and they could be absent for weeks on end, months, mm-hmm. who knows, I don't know how long it was, but certainly days, weeks, maybe even more. And that idea that there's nothing you can do to move out of the doldrums. There's no gas
in the engine. There's no wind in the sail.
Yeah.
There's no current in the sea.
Nothing to move you from the stillness of where you are. No activity present. Now that can get challenging.
And it's something that you and I have both been through.
Yeah.
And it's something that I have bumped into, and I'm sure you have too, in your work with people.
Mm-hmm.
I've certainly bumped into it
for sure.
Numerous times now, and more extents.
It's a thing.
Yeah, I see some people move through it relatively quickly. Others,
a sustained period.
Yeah, it can be quite a sustained. I mean, we're talking years, and for ourselves, I would say both of us.
So I'm going to maybe unpack it a little bit.
Mm.
So what can happen, and what did happen in our case, individually, and it just happened for us, is that awakening can occur, let's say a profound awakening, that's a shift into the non-personal, non-doing, non-dual awareness, where the ego's, the influence, the power, let's say, or the apparent power of the ego's gone.
Mm-hmm.
The orientation, the seeking, the way that the ego operates in the world autonomously, acts out its desires, seeks its fulfillments and all these things.
And the motivations.
And the motivations, exactly.
The purpose, the sense of why I do what I do.
Yes. When you awaken from that, there's a sense of obvious, there is a real sense of liberation. I'm free of that. I'm free of the tyranny of egoic life.
And it is a tyranny.
Yeah, there's a great metaphor we'll talk about later as well for this. And so the idea is then, oh, I'm free, I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
But in many ways, it leaves an absence.
Yeah. That's how it starts.
Often the immediate thing is, I'm free, I'm liberated, I am the no spacious small being. Self. But all that motivation's gone, all that orientation, all that seeking's gone, and that can be seen to be a really good thing. But also, what can happen is you go into a quiet mode, a mode where there's no motivation, where the ego and its drives have collapsed, let's say, or been seen through. But as yet, the deeper life movement, the current possibility of that, hasn't come yet.
Yeah.
It's a place, it's a bit like, we've talked about this, and I've heard this idea of the myth, the taking the biblical story of Exodus as a mythic pattern of what this looks like, and being under tyrannical be slaves under tyrannical rule, and that can be seen to be the ego. And obviously one seeks release from that, and then one does find release from that. Well, what happened in that mythic story? The Israelites found themselves in the wilderness with no structures, with no order, just wandering in the wilderness, actually in their case, for generations before the promised land came about.
Yeah.
And so we can see this acting out on an individual level. The ego collapses.
Yeah. And it really does act out that way.
It does, yeah. And you find yourself with nothing moving you.
Yeah.
That's why the doldrums, that was this idea of the doldrums, right?
Yeah. It's like there's nothing. So you've come into this shift, this new way of experiencing yourself and the world. And it's not like the doldrums is a bad thing, like, because there's this sense of underlying causeless peace, let's say the sense of okayness, the sense of, you know, that there's not the same suffering maybe that there's a liberation there for sure. But I've bumped into quite a few people, and I speak from my own experience here, where I was like, where's the joy, where's the bliss, where's the love, it's just a sort of a stage of emptiness, and it's beautiful, but it's quiet, and seemingly there's not any movement or impulse to act. It's all just everything's fine as it is kind of sense. I don't feel like I'm being very eloquent in describing it right now, but it's not a bad place to be. It's just a place that you find yourself,
and it's characterized by the absence of the very things that characterize egoic living.
Exactly.
And that's obviously a liberation from egoic living. It's huge. At the same time, you might go, oh, I can't do anything now.
Is this it?
And
I think both of us now? had that is this it?
For me, it was more, well, what now?
Yeah.
You know, it was fine. The itness of it is wonderful, beautiful.
Yes.
But the, okay, what now? where am I going to go? Am I done now?
Well, and then
what am I going to do with the rest of my life? I'm still here.
I remember distinctly feeling, and at the time I was sort of, I don't know how old I was, 30 something, going, I feel like I'm done. Like, it's not in a nihilistic sort of way of wanting to cease, it's not in a way of wanting to cease to exist in that sense, but just like, I've come here, I've done the thing that I came here to do. There's no other impulse of what am I going to do now? You know, what's life about now?
And I mean, for us, it was a while.
Yeah.
I mean, it's actually been quite a while. I'd say quite, because I think in the last few years, we've been moving out of it. And that's what can happen, right? First of all, there's the seeking of the ego that collapses, and then you're in a kind of a no man's land.
mm-hmm.
where actually there's no this is my experience, there was no motivation and no actually ability to take action in any particular direction. You're just sort of living on this, and there's some bliss in there, and there's some peace in there for sure. You know, when there's some freedom,
being free from the egoic structures,
exactly,
free
from the tyranny of the ego,
is huge.
But there was no motivating force.
There's an attraction as well.
Because all we'd known was the motivating force of the ego. The ego determining what happens when and who does it and in what relation to what and to what end. All that stuff gone. So we found ourselves very much just living without any purpose or without any deeper meaning or without any motivating force, it seemed to me.
Yeah.
Now what we discovered, each of us, and was that at some point down the line, the life force itself, the beingness itself, has its own wants for us in terms of activity, starts to motivate and move. You find yourself being moved, being motivated, but it's different.
From
it's
a
not
different place.
It's not a small ego. It's a deep inner movement up and out,
yeah,
stirring you from within, moving you to inclining you that way. That way,
it's a calling.
Yeah,
actually,
right.
Is what I started. And I think for me, the time period was about 2 years until I started to hear that calling.
Yeah, quietly.
It took a long time to actually come into being, but it was about 2 years that
the
really,
deep doldrums.
Yeah, the quietness of that. And I mean, for me, that those doldrum years, I look back on them now very differently than when I was going through it. When I was going through it, it felt unending. And I remember having this thing of like, God, life must have a better use for me than this. Like, I remember looking at the same four walls going, really? Like,
what am I for now?
Yeah. And not really having an answer to that, not really. And also not needing an answer for that, but at the same time, a sense that this can't be.
There's a nagging and. We've come across it with other people who we've worked with or observed who have come to this, and they can really come to a place of that can turn to a place of real nihilism.
It can
because you just imagine, oh God, this is it. I'm awake. My life's work has been fulfilled.
Yeah,
you know, from that perspective.
Well, your whole identity
is all
prior to that is wrapped up in being
totally.
A seeker and.
Yeah.
I mean, often, not for everyone, but for most people, you know, your whole orientation of life is seeking, for want of a better word, enlightenment. And here we are, there's been a shift of recognizing your true nature.
Yeah.
And it's like, what now?
But with it, the doer goes, that's part of the trouble, you see. This is why it's the doldrums. You know, the doer is the wind in the sail in some ways.
Yeah.
And so you find yourself in the having all the wind taken out of you, and the deep recognition that this is happening. There's no doer here, and still there's the echo of the mind and the constructs of the mind that are going, along with the realization that the mind just is not in control, never was. That deep realization that I can't move myself here. I have to be moved by and as and through life itself. Yeah. My own being as being has to move this organism up, down, left, right, whatever, has to motivate. And that's just absent in the doldrums.
Well, yeah, it's like the power is being cut to the fan.
Yeah.
It being the doer there is the fan, the power.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that it doesn't take a while to unwind. And so that's where I was just starting to go earlier, was like this sense of looking at it now, I see there was something going on in those doldrum years that I didn't see at the time. All I see at the time was, you know, what's the use of this? There's nothing going on.
Yes, that presumption of nothing going on.
Yeah, but actually I look back now and we're a number of years beyond that now.
Yeah.
And I see that there was on just such a fundamental level, a rewiring, an undoing of old ways of, almost like pathways of behavior, of seeing things, of doing things, the reason why and what motivated.
Yeah.
All the undoing, the breaking down of that. And in that gap, there was then the rebirth. It's a bit like the winter when everything dies back and you go, oh, there's nothing there. But actually underground, in the seeds of it all, there's so much going on. There's so much that on the surface level isn't visible. And so that's what I see now, is like that is a perfect setup for all that comes later in terms of the embodiment, the lived embodiment of
the sprouting of a kind of a new kind of living.
A new way of being.
A new way of being, yeah.
But I didn't see that at the time.
No, God, it was interminable. It felt like it was going on for years. And and again, you've only just, in those, because it's right after the awakening.
There's a bit of a honeymoon phase for most.
There's a bit of a honeymoon, but there's also the, what now? How am I going to, And so you're shedding, in a way, some of the vestiges, a lot of the vestiges of egoic thinking, even though the ego is no longer in place. Some of the, there's still these, the old operating system is there in a kind of a, in an echo form.
It is. And so there's a lot of, for me at least, there was a lot of unwinding of things like old traumas and wounds and conditioned patterns and thinking and ways of being. Which I didn't give value to at the time. Like I was walking through it, but I didn't give value to the reprogramming that was going on from the ground up.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of it, a lot of the trouble that might come around from, and I've talked a little bit about this before, about certain presumptions about enlightenment. There were so many, and I remember at the time, it became almost like a mission. And a bit of anger in there, going,
oh, yeah.
God, these myths around what enlightenment is and what it looks like, and I think a lot of them aren't even the fault of spiritual teachers and teachings. A lot of it is to do with the fact that the seeker is projecting a sort of a perfect state on its own terms.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I remember thinking, God, none of the spiritual teachers I'd been exposed to talked about, either what we experienced as a sort of a detox.
Yeah.
They didn't talk about
integration
or the doldrums or the fact that it's not always heady bliss. It's not going to be like you suddenly land in, well, the land of milk and honey. It's not necessarily immediately that. I remember being
No one told us
about this.
And even just like, they barely even make it a footnote.
Yes, barely a footnote. But now I look back, I actually see a lot of teachers were actually talking about this. I just realized I as a seeker was, as I'm following the teaching, but I'm also, like an ego does, selectively, picking out what this is going to look like.
We really do. We hear, what is it called? Confirmation bias. We hear what we call
motivated reasoning and stuff like that. Yeah, another one.
Yeah. And actually, I don't think it's a wrong thing. I think it's because actually, had I heard all of this before, had I really heard all of this before, and here we are, lifting the veil of it, and I'm happy to do that. I think it's necessary to do that.
Yeah.
But there is part of me that would have been like, well, that doesn't sound that great.
I remember, it's really funny, actually. There was someone who we had worked with at some point, and for some reason, like, for example, let me see if I can unpack this properly. I, in my teaching and my writing and whatnot, although I'm aiming to point to the fact that the only place we're going to find lasting happiness is through the discovery of our true nature.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nominally a path towards that, and that unfolds and unpacks, and perhaps one follows a path of sort of increasing charm. But it's also a deeply destructive process.
Yeah.
And it's not to be taken lightly in some ways. Mostly we're called to it, to be fair. It's whether, whether we know it or not, whether it's framed in our experience like that or not. But when someone comes and they have views about, oh, help me, you know, let's get into this work and see if we can sort of discover this and what this gonna, my life's gonna be, all my problems will be solved through this.
Mm-hmm.
What can happen is I'm like, you know, don't take it lightly. Don't imagine it's all gonna be, you know, sweetness and light. It's challenging. And
on every level.
And it can be, I mean, some like breeze into it and it's totally, it doesn't show up as a problem at all. In fact, be really personal. But for a lot, and I would go as far as say the majority.
I would too.
It can be a really disruptive and destructive process.
Yeah, a really profound and necessary process.
Right from the very, literally from the very core of what you take yourself to be and what is true.
And
it's life shattering.
It is, but just to temper that also with what it is shattering is that which you aren't.
It is. And so the truth of it is...
The ego will take that and go, oh my God. Exactly. But it is actually that which is shattered, not yes. your true nature, not your true being. In fact, it's a liberation for your true self.
It is, exactly. It really it's both is. Of those things. And so, but I remember working with someone and they said, you really didn't sell it, you know, because they had an awakening after them. But I remember them saying, oh, you really didn't sell this at the time. And part of me feels like a responsibility to actually communicate that, look, do take it seriously. Do take it soberly. Do take it earnestly. It is the fulfillment of our nature. It's the rediscovery and the fulfillment of what it is to be alive and embodied. At the same time, don't imagine that it is the solution to specific worldly problems and all these things. It's so much deeper and so much more profound than that.
Yeah.
And it is.
And it is the best thing that you can do for yourself and
Absolutely.
The world. I stand by that, but it doesn't mean that it's an easy journey.
No. And, you know, even now I'm risking underselling it. It's, I remember Maharshi said, when Maharshi Mahesh Yogi, you know, he was in the business of enlightenment, let's say, with his meditation and whatnot. And he had read an article, someone said something like, oh, this meditation then, your programs, this knowledge of awakening, of enlightenment, is a cure to all problems. And he went, no. And you'd think that was a really big statement to say it solves all the problems. He goes, no, we shouldn't even be thinking about it in the same breath as problems.
Yeah.
It's on another level. And I mean, of course, that's soaring rhetoric there, but it is kind of true as well. At the same time, it can be challenging on the human level, really can be.
Really.
But also, there's so much beauty in that. And even in that challenge,
challenge in the best
the fullness,
sort of way.
The best possible way, you know.
Yeah, it really is. And yet, it doesn't negate the challenge of it.
No.
I was, as you were speaking there, the phrase came, and it's not a new phrase, but it is a phrase that it feels very relevant to this conversation, and that is, there's no true informed consent for awakening.
It's true, yeah. Yeah. How can the ego consent? You don't know until you... And yet, funnily enough, when the awakening does come about, it's found to be, oh, this is the same awareness that was all the same self that was already there.
Because it's just, Sahaja Samadhi is the natural state.
Yeah.
It is the recognition of that which was always looking out of these eyes, just unseen to itself.
Yeah, unrecognized.
Yeah.
So normal mind is actually enlightened mind.
Yeah.
Awakened mind. And it's because you can end up looking for another mind
behind you somehow,
a different mind. Or I'll slip over into enlightened mind from my normal mind and dispense with that. But actually, as you say, it's the same eyes, it's the same knowing, but it's recognized for what it is, you know.
Exactly. So yeah, I now look at those doldrum years in great fondness, even though in a worldly sense there wasn't much going on.
No.
But in a spiritual sense, an evolution sense in terms of my being, there was so much going on. And it was unseen, like I said, in the outer view of it, there was so much unseen, even to myself, I would say. But it was just, it was like a rewiring going on. That's how I would describe it, a rewiring. What's the word? The word leveling up comes, but that's not the right word.
Well, is a butterfly leveling up from a caterpillar? I don't know.
Yeah,
not quite.
Exactly.
I mean,
it's
each
not
one
right
is correct
word.
In its own way. But yeah, it's a shift of
new operating system. That's the word.
Yeah, it was. That's how it. Yeah,
that's the word I was after. New operating system, and that takes time to live into. That takes time to even get the bearing of it.
You
of
are
the
not
ground.
Given a manual. I remember feeling that at the time. I wish I had a book on this that I could, you know, I'd read all the books about, you know, how to get to awakening and what we know, all that stuff. But it did feel
there
like there
be.
Wasn't. What?
There can't be a manual.
No, because everyone's unique. But
Sorry, I just interrupted you there.
No, it's fine. Totally fine.
Got excited.
There is one. There can't be.
There isn't a manual. There can't be, because what your individual, unique, embodied expression looks like, feels like, tastes like, is experienced like, is entirely unique. And there's where there can't be a manual. And I think what drove me and inspired me and called me to do this kind of work was the recognition that post-awakening support and mentoring is what is needed. It's not about teaching at that point. It's about holding each other's hands while we walk through this. And I had that with you. You had that with me.
Yeah.
And we had other people in our lives on occasion. But I see the necessity of that and the lack of that, because there's been so much attention on seeking.
Yeah, getting there.
Now what?
Yeah.
And I think that we're coming into a phase in our current iteration of humanity where there is a lot of awakening happening. You just have to look around and you see it.
Yeah.
And so now there's a different kind of a necessity, and that is how to live. Yeah. In this world.
I think a lot of your, I mean, I noticed you in particular, I mean, a lot of your work is actually holding and, you know, guiding,
supporting,
post-awakening.
Yeah. It's my favorite kind of work, I think. Just because I think there's a necessity to it. It's not that I, you know, each stage of the butterfly caterpillar experience has its beauty, has its difficulties.
It's a different mode though, isn't it?
It is a different mode. The rules that work for the caterpillar don't work for the butterfly, and vice versa.
Right on.
So I think that's why I feel so passionate about that kind of work, is because I think it's a different kind of relationship also at that point.
Yeah.
And I think there's more of it that's needed in this world right now. And I think there is more of it available as well. It's not, you know, as is needed, there's more available.
Yeah.
Because there isn't a manual. It's not about getting a manual at that point, finding a manual. It is about actually, I would say, coming to trust yourself more and more. That's what I think the process is, actually, is about. Unwinding all the mistrust of oneself and sinking into and learning how to trust your true self and your true sense of of how this life is moving through you and the correctness of that and the embodiment of that, and then therefore the blossoming and the growth of that.
Well, that's the great characteristic of awakened life, is, I would say, spontaneity. Mm-hmm. It's not just, I don't mean that in a very superficial sense. Oh, I'm going to go off and throw the frisbee. You know, it's not, although that too. But what I mean to say is very specifically that one's life is moved spontaneously in without individual causing.
Mm.
It's happening in this way, it's happening that way. And it's a very human experience. I was thinking about this earlier.
Yeah, so right.
Even though we are divine consciousness nature, that's the discovery. Even though we're beyond the personal self-image, the egoic self, this experience is human.
Yes.
It's divine human, but it's human. And so we have a psychology.
Yeah.
In awakening, we have a body, we have a mind, we have an intellect, we have behaviors. It's just in awakening those are found, noticed to be impersonal, that they're spontaneous.
There we go. Spontaneous arising, temporary, spontaneous arising.
But it's human. The experience is still human. So it's not like you're removed at a distance from your humanity.
I would say it's the opposite, actually. Yeah, and I think that really surprises people a lot is the imagination, and actually myself as well, I would say I wouldn't have thought that.
Yeah, you expect you'd be floating in as an ocean of bliss and somehow
witness.
Because we talk about the witness, don't we? And that's true.
Yeah.
But the experience is still human. The experience
it's very intimate,
you know,
raw, human, vivid. If anything, I would say post-awakening, the experience is even more human.
Yeah.
I think after a time, initially it might not feel that way, but as it matures, it becomes more and more embodied, more and more human.
It was the
and
raw,
real and raw.
Yeah. It was, you know, when I think back to my, you know, my first impressions of this, coming into this, even before I really kind of had a fuller sense of what was happening, it was raw, unfiltered. Those were the kind of,
those were the words,
and it still is now, but you know,
you get used to it
because you realize, the world still is what it was, except it isn't what it was, right? It's that kind of riddle.
Yes.
But the sheer nakedness, I love that. Simone Weil, who wrote Live Naked, Nailed to the Tree of Life.
Mm.
I know, I just love that. Or what was the other one? Rilke, Let It All Happen to You, Beauty and Terror, Just Keep Going, No Feeling is Final.
Mm.
And actually, I love the last line of that. Don't let yourself forget me.
Mm. Yeah, you were saying that the other day.
Yeah, that Rilke poem is quite famous. Let It All Happen to You, Beauty and Terror. Just keep going. No feeling is final. And it's about letting it all in, letting it all, self-experience it all. But it was written, as I understand it, as a kind of a dictation from God, a literary dictation from God.
Beautiful.
So it was God speaking. That's God saying, let it all happen to you. But they seem to leave the last line off, you know, no feeling is final becomes the poignant line at the end.
Which is a great
way to end it. But I love that. Don't let yourself lose me in amongst all that. I am.
Yeah. And there's.
And it's raw.
There's
it's all
the circle closing for me. It's like that in that poem. Like when you told me that last line, I'd never heard that last line. Yeah. I've heard the other part quite a few times.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like the image that came is when you said that last line, it's like the circle closing.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
It's like the completeness of that, the wholeness of that suddenly was put in its context, in its
that
wholeness.
That amongst all that beauty and terror and these the passing feelings that you let in and allow and don't offer resistance to them, and because none of them are final. There's this I am
underlying
that. I'm holding you the whole time. The divine, your yeah. divine nature is holding you the whole time.
It sort of says everything in many ways. If you, it's funny as we're talking, I was just really feeling into that and feeling that actually, if you just meditated on that yeah. alone,
yeah.
Yeah. And there's plenty of things in life like that, but that just as we're talking about this particular one.
I love this rawness.
Like it's all in there, actually. Everything yeah. is in there.
I love this rawness, though, and this is so often not reported as some do, like the Zen people do, and some, like say, Simone Weil and Rilke, you know, the literary sense, they speak to this. Raw aliveness, and I think people like Pema Chodron do as well. She talks about, you know, the brokenheartedness, the spilling out of being, the non-resistance to yeah. beauty and terror, all of it.
All of it.
And that fundamental rawness that is this awakened being.
Yeah.
It's too easy to, as a seeker, to project into the safe space of awareness.
Vanilla,
yeah.
Life is a vanilla.
Yeah, pablum.
I like vanilla, but yeah, yes.
No, you're right. Vanilla.
Yeah.
Just equanimity all the way along, and no yeah. distinctions, no diversity, of experience.
But it's in that diversity that you find the unity. It's not. Yeah. They're not. Two things. It's yeah. like literally the diversity yeah. is the unity of it all.
Yeah.
And vice versa, the yeah. unity is the diversity
and
of
so,
it all.
Yeah, and so leaning into the whole, the rawness and the nakedness of, and the headiness that idea that we're talking about last week about being on the prow of a ship, heading off into uncharted waters, the spray and the wind in your face, it's or the free fall, you know, that ever present sense and reality that we are free falling endlessly. There's nothing to hold on to. No parachute, as Jogim Trungpa say. You know, you're falling through the air. Nothing to hold on to. No parachute. That's the bad news. The good news is there's no ground.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite quotes.
Yeah. And so that idea, that feeling, when you actually just recognize and feel into that, you realize yeah. the rawness of that.
Yeah, you're sort of...
The nakedness of
Yeah, you're falling through the air, but it's sort of at some point, so there's the initial terror of that, but at some point, there's an acclimatization that happens. And I always get this image, and I've shared it a number of times with people, but I'll share it here because I haven't yet. And the image I always get is you're falling, you're free fall. Ah. I don't want to shout too loudly into the mic, but and it's happened long enough and sufficiently enough that you at some point you stop screaming and you start looking around, and you're still in that free fall, but you sort of start brushing your teeth and you start sitting on your chair and you're like, okay, all right, okay, this is the new norm. Yeah. That there is this free fall, and yet of this happens within that free fall.
And our tension in living, because that, you know, it's a metaphor, but actually it's kind of a points to a reality.
Literal. Yeah.
We're you know, careening into, you know, emptiness, into space, unknowingness.
But it's the bottom, it's the good news bit where he said there's no ground. That's what makes all the
And so
the
if
difference.
We're always imagining there's a ground, so we tense up with
the
free
fall. Yeah, we're going to go splat.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to go splat at some point. But once you realize, oh no, this is our just, nature. Yeah. This is the nature of this reality that we're inhabiting.
Yeah.
And there is no ground.
That's this it. Is no, the ground.
No feeling is final. It's
this
that idea.
This free fall is the ground,
It's ground.
Say.
The groundless
ground. The groundless ground.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
And when there's a recognition of that, or a sinking into that, a softening into that, a sense of relaxation into that, this is where I would say the emptiness becomes the fullness again.
Right.
And that's what I mean about the brushing the teeth. You know, the fullness of life, the human experience of life starts to interrupt into that and be recognized as actually not separate from that, but happening within that.
Mm.
And is part of that, yeah. A beautiful part of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wonder if we might pivot just a minute.
Yeah.
And I'm actually going to pivot to something that I think you should talk, that you want to talk about, that you maybe don't even know you want to talk about, but it just feels appropriate.
Go for it.
And I won't be able to say the word.
Oh, I know what you're talking
about. you've been this week.
A word has really captured my, I know the one, your epictasis. Yes, I think it's epictasis.
Epictasis.
Epictasis. Yeah, it's a word I came across from, it's Greek, it's ancient Greek. I mean, I think the ancient Greeks used it, but then it was also used by Gregory of Nyssa, who was a great, great father of the early church, a great mystic, a great theologian, and he uses the word, and it points to a particular idea, which is to say something like the condition of eternal rest, eternal peace, eternal, you know, what would
completeness.
You say? Completeness.
Unity.
Doneness, unity. And at the same time, endless and perpetual evolution within that singularity.
Yeah.
I mean, he might have phrased it in a more kind of theological way, but it really points to the experience of awakening being both a final condition.
Yes.
Awaken to your nature, your true nature. And yet, at the same time, within that happiness, within that fulfillment, within that finality.
Yeah, the sense of all as well.
Yes, the complete, full stop of coming into your own awakened being, which is eternal and ever-present. The endless, deepening evolution, growth that still continues to happen from within that without ever taking away from the fullness and the completion of the awakening itself.
It seems like such a paradox, and yet the lived experience is that.
Yeah.
It is that. I can't say that enough, I feel like. It's like anyone who thinks that there isn't a continued evolution.
Yeah.
I think is missing part of the beauty of life, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, but it's happening from within the perfection of that singularity, that oneness, the divine oneness that we are. It's remarkable. And I love it when I find that there's a word for it.
Yes.
You know, because that's been the experience, and that's almost been a little paradox.
Yeah.
Again, post awakening, you come into awakening and suddenly, you know, it's all this, the ego's sort of gone as a motivator, as an automaton, and the sense of can arise, well, what now then? Am I just gonna kind of, you know, I actually felt that I've talked about this before, about this nirvanic sense of what it is to come into enlightenment. And I realize how much I was informed by that viewpoint, that this idea that, let's say, the Buddha, the original conception of the Buddha, or the story of the Buddha, is, you know, here's this prince who renounces everything, and despite all odds, he attains perfect enlightenment. Teaches for about 40 years, and then he poof extinguishes into oblivion. And part of this account of those the years where he's awake but still alive is something like, and I've heard this in spiritual circles, you're sort of running down your karma, right? Something like that. You're burning up whatever karma's sort of left. That idea. So that feeling, based on those sort of ideas, are, well, I'm just gonna you know, run down the clock then, I guess. But which, I guess in my case, I was, I guess in my, what, mid, late 40s by that point, you were in, you're still in, just coming into your 30s or something.
Yeah, I was in, yeah.
30, whatever.
Late 20s, yeah.
Right. Whatever, you know, and yeah. So you were really young. I was still pretty young.
But I felt that running out the clock. I remember those doldrums, that is actually what sort of, it did feel now? Like that.
And a lot of the messaging I would hear around that is, just enjoy every moment. Life's a garden of bliss. And that's not untrue as well, okay? Yeah, you know, that is an approach. But it didn't, so it was like, okay, well, I guess that's it then. Yeah. And just, you know, carpe the DM, you know. And
carpe them DMs.
Carpe them DMs. And I enjoy the moment, which is true, because that's almost a trite. That's almost a trite kind of response to it, because I actually didn't anticipate the fact that, oh, this movement will grab me.
Yeah.
This movement, this being will take a direction.
It does.
And it almost invariably, I don't come across people who personally, and, you know, that I've come across who have necessarily not had that movement stir them at some point. It can take a while.
And though, actually, I couldn't have heard that when I was going through that phase.
No.
If someone had told me that, I think someone did tell me that actually. And I was like, no. You're living it, and so you don't see.
Well, we're like the Jews wandering through the desert for generations, as it turned out.
Yeah.
And there's nothing there. Except, you know, every morning, you know, God would send manna, you know, bread from heaven to feed them, but basic provisions and little birds, apparently, these little birds. And so they were fed. And that's what our experience. We were fed.
Yeah.
We had a roof over our head.
Life wasn't bad.
We had, you know, but, you know, we didn't. Yeah. It was just very, we were living on this very sort of basic sustaining, and it was almost like life was sustaining us without surplus.
Yes. And so I want to, you know, it was sort of this emptiness was there, but it wasn't unpleasant at all.
No,
it wasn't bad. It was there was a lot of bliss there.
Yeah, there's a lot of openness. Yeah,
yeah, it was just wasn't like the vitality of life hadn't yet sort of fully kicked into gear again.
Yeah, no direction was being taken.
And I remember at the time really thinking it never would again.
Yeah, like, idling, let's say, you know.
I'm like, I just can't imagine. Yeah, at the time it was just.
It was unimagined. It was like, I don't know, this is it now.
Well, there wasn't any desire to imagine into it almost. No. I don't know how to describe that, but it's like you just, there's this contentment with what was.
Yeah.
And yet,
but actually it did show up sometimes as, oh, for God's sake, can we,
on occasion.
You know, because you realize you're not doing, there's no power, but the mind's still commenting on.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, what's happening, which is quite novel.
But the green shoots did come.
They really did.
And then the forest grew.
Yeah, it's still growing.
Yeah, I was about to say, very much. Yeah,
a direction, a sense of purpose, meaning.
Yeah, deep meaning. My God, I had no idea what meaning was until, I mean, even now I feel like I'm still barely scratching the surface in some ways. It's like every day that the upswelling depth of the beauty and meaning of this life as sacredness is what is, it's like I don't have the breath and the words to say it somehow. The love of life.
Yeah. Well, that was another thing, wasn't it? I mean, after awakening, I mean, it was really interesting because we basically woke up within 6 months of each other and it was profound, and we you know, each of us came quite clearly into that, which I thought itself was an incredible coincidence.
Well, I don't think there's any mistakes. I think absolutely there's a mistake.
I think, you know, we were talking with someone the other day about this, that the particularities of our individual and joint path probably going off in a slightly different direction here, but you know, when we first got together as a couple all those years ago, what, 19 years ago now?
Yeah.
Ish. Yeah, actually 19 years next month, right. So we got together and it was got together in the context of a spiritual community. We were both, you know, meditators and, you know, very much involved with oriented. You were born into it, whereas I sort of, you know, I found it.
I think we learned to meditate at the same time, except for I was like 4 or 5 years old.
I was like 20 or whatever,
yeah.
So we came together like that, and I remember we had just rented our first house. We were we'd been together, I don't know how long at that time, 6 months, a year maybe?
Not even that much.
It was months, and maybe 6 months down the line.
Close to 6 months.
Yeah. I had to move, and then we went, hey, let's do this together. So we did.
Yeah.
It was quite clear right from the start that we were, you know, co-joined.
Yeah, this was something else. This was something. Yeah.
Even though we were scrappy at that time, and it wasn't so clear that, you know, in the early days, you don't know, do you? And that's where this idea of, you know, walk away or double down come we sort of emerged as a
theme,
you know, when it is, I think it is for a lot of people who get into a relationship to start, you don't know whether this is gonna be the one that takes you, you know, a long way down the road together, or you're just gonna, you know, if a problem arises, you don't know whether that means you should walk away. So we kept doubling down, but there was one point at which, as we were in a sense coming to really, really deeply know each other and know what we each of us were about, and it was quite clear that at that time I was really about just enlightenment. That was my ultimate, and had been for a while. And
you made no qualms with.
I made no qualms about it, but my
obvious.
My view of what that was going to look like. We talked. I don't know if we talked about this before.
I don't think we've talked about it on the podcast. We've done interviews where we've talked about this. But
my view of what that was going to look like was, I have to go off on my own
into the
hills, so to speak, whether literally or just metaphorically. I was going to go off, go forth, and you know, do.
I thought you were going to, you like the cave was calling you.
Exactly. At some point, the cave was calling me. But here I was in a fresh relationship with you. And we had quite a frank discussion where it was like, we should probably split up right now. Because honestly, the idea is at some point I'm going to go off someone's heart. If not both, are going to get broken by that. And let's just not bother.
Yeah, because that was, you made it very clear. That was the most important thing.
Yeah.
For you.
Yeah.
Enlightenment
and I
was
felt
your
that,
north compass.
Yeah. And my paradigm and my understanding at that time was that's a singular thing you have to go off and do on your own.
Yeah, it's going to take everything.
It's going to take everything.
Renounce
and that,
everything.
It was, renunciation. And I was just gearing up for that. So there's no point getting into a long-term relationship. And we broke up on that basis for about a week.
Yeah.
And like the moment you were like, okay, I'm going, you know, back home. And I was sort of there in my house now. And I was like, my heart was broken from the moment you left the door. And I realized, whatever. I'm not going to be able to do this without you.
Yeah.
And likewise, and I think within a week we were back together, and I thought, we'll figure it out. I'll figure it out.
Yeah.
And it was so remarkable that, you know, in all those years, that this presumption of what it would take to become awake, the presumption that you have to do it alone, and that an earthly relationship, a romantic partnership is going to be a distraction or an obstruction.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've seen that messaging all over the shot in various spiritual teachings and circles and whatever.
Yeah, it's a pernicious idea, although as the years went on, and as we deepened spiritually, individually and together, at these varying turns, you know, in these various sort of point, let's say crisis points, say, mm-hmm. where we'd hit these crisis points in our relationship, and you know that our shorthand was, you walk away, you double down,
yeah,
you know, you redouble, you deepen into this, or you just step off,
yeah,
and each time, you know, it's crisis, you know, so what do they say, you know, crisis, danger and opportunity, you know, holding hands and.
It's a risk. The way I see it, you hit to the edge of something.
Yeah.
And the risk is going beyond that edge. Do you fall apart or do you fall into a depth of deeper love? Yeah,
deeper love.
Deeper understanding, deeper insight, deeper wisdom. But it's an edge. You're hitting into your limit, your edge.
Yeah.
And you're going beyond it ultimately.
And I never realized, it took years to realize that. Not only was my relationship with you, not only did I awaken in spite of it, you were intrinsic to it.
I agree.
Our relationship, to me as well, right? Yeah. Our relationship was intrinsic to each of our awakening.
Absolutely.
Good, because the power of a really conscious coupling is unbelievable. I had no idea. To have
an easy path.
It's not an easy path.
It's pretty intense.
Because you're doing your work in real time together.
You're doing not only your work, their work, and vice versa.
Yeah, and having to hold all that. It's like high altitude training. It really is absolutely crazy. But what an amazing.
It is. It's intense.
And so what's crazy about the, you know, how that kind of, in a sense, culminated with a non-dual breakthrough on both of our parts within months of each other.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a laugh at the way that, you know, like if you say something like, oh, you know, relationships are going to hold you back. It's like life goes, oh, hold my beer.
Here we go.
And then demonstrates not only that it's not true, but it's in fact the opposite. I mean,
for us, exactly.
And some people.
It's not the case for everyone, of course.
But we're the living sort of demonstration of the fact that it's not an obstacle. It's not necessarily an obstacle. And actually, it can be really, really powerful catalyst for individual and collective change.
Yeah. In a relationship, there's no hiding.
No.
I think that's the biggest thing, is like it's just this mirror to everything, and so there's no hiding in that. And the ego loves nothing other than to hide often in plain sight, and so you know, whenever we bump into something, and you know, occasionally we still do, it's like there is no hiding in that. No hiding. And so it's like, okay, we're in this, we buckle up. It's like you get this sort of sense of, like, you know, one of those race car seats where there's the proper straps.
And buckle in there. Yeah.
It's like that. Okay, buckle up. Here we go. In this until we're through it.
Yeah.
And that's for me what it's taken is that sort of buckling in, that doubling down, that
That's so beautiful.
Yeah. It really is. It's challenging.
Yeah.
But it's so, so rewarding. Beautiful. Yeah.
So rewarding.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly.
And, you know, I had no idea that it could operate on such a profound level. No. On the highest level of the highest, you know, our highest nature.
This relationship has by far been my greatest teacher.
Me too.
And continues to be.
Yeah. Despite my...
your protestation of you've got to go off into your cave.
Yeah. And again, it's if you're sincere, if you're earnest, then everything. I wrote this down the other day just before I was going to have a session with someone. It just came to me, and it was this: in this teaching, we use everything.
Yes,
that was the line.
Yeah, there is nothing that
it's outside.
Is not I would call it not satsang.
Yeah, it's not you. In this teaching, we use wisdom. Everything. Everything is used. Yeah. Everything is grist for the mill.
Yeah, relationships, kids, work,
family,
all of it, and grief, everything more.
Distress, illness, all of it. Yeah,
all of it.
Everything, and it is that radical inclusion that is liberation. Actually,
it is. It is the inclusion of it all. is the freedom from it all as well.
Yeah. So it right in, and so we lived with mirrors. With them, you had one, I had one. We were each other's mirror.
Yeah.
And
we still do.
We still do. Still are. So it was interesting that we both had a profound spiritual shift within several months, and then.
I think no mistake, because I think if it hadn't have happened, I'm not sure we would have survived that as a relationship. No, actually.
we'd had sort of I wouldn't say minor shifts, but shifts, not the full non-dual, let's say, but we'd had shifts beforehand.
Yeah,
and in one case, it was particularly you had got ahead of me in a sense, because that was the sense of it. Like, you had had this this glimpse, this real, sort of for a few
profound
days,
opening,
a profound opening, which not only was a glimpse that shut down, but yet in some sense it did shut down, but it left you more open than you were, spiritually it didn't more aware.
Completely shut down.
Yeah, it changed you.
It did, and profoundly. I would say.
Before that, I felt, we were kind of leveling, and then suddenly it was like, you actually, I'm
seeing
not,
life in a different way.
You were more, that shift. And it was lovely too. It was beautiful because you were a bliss bubble for, And
life
that actually
was pretty good. Yeah.
And, but it wasn't like a big. We were still kind of very much together in this and oriented spiritually. But then the next was, we had this big shift. I had it, and you did say
about a year later.
I had a very big one, which was quite a.
Well, that was an abiding shift. These words, I think, technically are important.
Yeah, abiding. It was an abiding shift. So the shift that you had experienced a year prior.
Yeah,
it was
non-abiding.
It was non-abiding.
Although there was an opening that.
Yeah, that retained you. The aperture, let's say, it opened.
Widened.
Yeah.
Post that.
Widened,
yeah.
Yeah. So a year later, I had an abiding shift into non-duality. And, that was challenging for a while.
For us, well, yeah.
For
we,
both,
we
for
separated
us, I mean, yeah,
bit.
We separated for a while. Not intentionally,
no,
just
no.
By virtue of
life circumstances.
Life circumstances. And again, it was the Leela played out in the way it played out. Yeah. And then again, a few months later, you also had an abiding shift into non-duality. So, and then we were both. Ah, wow. Here we are. What the,
Yeah. Yeah, I feel very grateful for you. Well, you know this.
Yeah, well, the feeling is entirely and wholeheartedly mutual, my love.
I do feel that we have people come into our lives that even if they are seemingly a bad situation for us or someone that is not a positive influence on life. So either positive or negative. I'm using these in fairly superficial terms right now. That people come into our lives very purposefully.
Yeah.
And help walk us through the things that we need to walk through.
Yeah.
Even if we don't see it that way at the time, even if we can't have that perspective, and we don't have to have that perspective, we're still walking through it. But these people, everyone, walks us through a stage of evolution, of growth that is necessary.
Yeah, it's that everything, isn't it? We use everything. Everything is it. Everything that happens what did some, the quote, consider everything that happens as a communication of God directly to your soul.
Mm.
It's a sort of a one way of putting that. The other way is, it's all satsang. Mm-hmm. It's all your satsang.
Yeah.
Everything is revealing you to you.
Yes.
Even if you can't see that that's happening. And my sense is the whole field of being is orchestrated towards its own awakening at all levels, and all levels of deepening also. Nothing is excluded from that.
Absolutely. So yeah, to use everything.
Yeah.
To be open to everything. To not shut down the possibility that the very thing you think is worth nothing in terms of your spiritual growth, that actually might be the very thing that is the diamond.
Yeah.
To not be complacent to the gifts that life brings you, and to recognize that gifts aren't always easy gifts, nice gifts.
You know, we have this view often, although let's say the collective view, the consensus view is something very banal, which is, you know, we're born, get an education, we, you know, get a job, get a family together, buy a house, whatever, maybe have a few nice experiences, and then you retire and spend a few years fishing or traveling, and then it's over. Just nothing could be further from the reality that I conceive and that I see. This idea that, and therefore from within that paradigm, from within that framework, the expectation is that life should be pleasurable, mm-hmm. should be measured by things like how healthy you are, how many holidays you have, and good experiences, and bad experiences are bad, and you know, there's that kind of judgment on the experiences we get.
And none of those experiences are wrong, per se.
Well, that's it. And it's,
but they have a different purpose, I think, than just the experiences themselves.
I think we've lost the context and the understanding that life is for us, however it shows up.
Yeah.
That if we are, and if we're exposed to something that's difficult, challenging, or nominally unwanted, then that's the place. That's actually the place where we can deepen and enrich and grow more awake and more wise.
That's the place where the light enters.
Yeah, that's it. Right, right. And whatever's happening to us is happening for us.
Yeah.
And that's a different experience. It's not that, and the best sometimes I see, which isn't great, is a sort of a stoic view of life, which is to say, I don't want to misrepresent stoicism per se, but the idea that, well, if times are tough, then, you know, you take it as it comes and, you know, what? Hold fast, you know, in spite of, put a brave face on it, or at least not. Even maybe a little deeper than that, which is to say, come to see that these vicissitudes are inevitable, and therefore one should accept them.
Yeah, but suffering is part of life. I guess these kind of things.
Right, but I think there's a really deeper one, which recognizes that this whole field of being is a big stirring pot of love and it's all for us. It's all for us. But who's the us it's for? And that's the trouble. If we think the us it's for is the personal us who seeks comfort and wealth and safety. Pleasure.
Safety. I think fundamentally it's a big one.
Yeah.
There.
The us that life is for is the true deep spiritual nature that we are.
Yeah.
That is begging and calling to be rediscovered and reintegrated. And that's not to deny the person. It's not to deny it, it's actually to include it. And then the person gets to have a rich, beautiful experience. It's challenging indeed, you know, live naked, nailed to the tree of life kind of experience. But it's who we are is served by this life, by this orchestration of circumstance. And so I see either way how our individual and collective life has played out.
Mm-hmm.
And I can go, wow, what an amazing feat of orchestration.
Yes, so true. Right?
Look around, see everything, and look, my God, if that hadn't have happened at that point, that wouldn't have happened there. That
I know, it's quite a miracle.
It's miraculous. Yeah. It's so deep and it's so infinitely intelligent and complex, the way it's all being orchestrated with such grace.
We get so blind to that. We get so blind to that. And I think when that blindness sort of kicks in there, where we don't see the miraculous in every breath.
Yeah.
It's, and you know, we've spoken about this before, but it's like when you're blind to that, the mystery, the miraculous nature of life, it all does become a bit flat and a bit meaningless and a bit sort of, without love, actually, without a lived experience of love as being itself.
Yeah, I love the Yoga Vasishtha, the story of Yoga Vasishtha. And I probably have talked about this before. I obviously have some favorites here. when the story of the young Lord Rama, you know, a prince, son of the great king of the time, and one of the sons, and he had fallen into a state of melancholic depression, and he was wandering around. And of course, he's lived in this incredible palace, much like the story of the Buddha, actually, you know, protected from all the nothing that isn't beautiful and wonderful was, you know, showed to him, and that was the environment he lived in. But he was miserable. He was moping around, and you know, had all these, you know, beautiful buildings and flowers and women, and you know, living the princely life, clothes, all
the good life,
the good life. But he was just miserable. And the king called the preceptor in, you know, the guru, and said, "Can you do something with Rama, please? Because he's just bumming everyone out." And he basically initiated Rama into his own true self, showed him his own true nature. And it was at that point where what was then what was on the face of it, this beautiful environment, was just seen as just miserable. But then when he discovered his true self, it suddenly became this garden of joy again. It was on the basis of his true nature. But life can get, if we don't have our foundation, the ground of our nature discovered, no matter how beautiful this life is on its own relative level, it can turn into horror, misery, just a prison. It's like you've been locked in a fairground for, you know, 1,000 years. You've been on every ride again and again and again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to someone who looks and goes, "Hey, look, it's a fairground. It should be fantastic." And you're like, "I really am done with this place. I've
been doing this for an eternity."
Yeah, exactly. And that's life. And then suddenly you're introduced to your true nature and it can become joyful again. It doesn't need to be on its own terms, but at some point you have to find your source, find who you are. And if you see that relativity is just going to continue on and on and on in this sort of cycle of you know, pleasure, fleeting, 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 it gets old. As you say, you got to find your deeper ground. In the light of which, life becomes bliss again.
Take a while, but yes, it does.
So... So how do, all right, let me ask you, for you, how did the doldrums resolve themselves for you? What how did that shift from, you know, the windless sea?
It was little tiny green shoots. Very tender little green shoots of, I would call it inspiration.
Uh-huh.
Another word would be to say a calling in the heart.
Right.
A sense of deeper purpose that I didn't know what it looked like in terms of enactment, in terms of, like, much of my life has been characterized with a sense of walking through life almost like you're walking through a fog, not seeing what is beyond that. Mm. That's a lot of, I would say, my life has been characterized in that, even though getting a sense of it in my heart well before I see what that actually practically looks like. Mm. So I think that's what shifted for me, was a sense in my heart of something. And I think the word I would use of that calling is service.
Right.
A sense of service, a sense of that is my calling. And, you know, service looks like many different things, but I got a sense of what that might look like for mm-hmm. me. And it was like, I think what it is when I'd done enough, I don't want to say all the self-work, but enough self-work, enough detoxification of my wounds and conditioning and all the rest of that, I think then I became available.
Mm.
Like, it's almost like I had to fill up my cup, and that cup then had to overflow.
Nice.
And I think that's what I now see in terms of those doldrum years, is that it was a cup being emptied of one juice,
yeah,
and filled of another.
Yeah.
And then when that cup was filled to the brim, that cup started to sort of splash over.
Mm.
And I think I would characterize that as service, and that service for me is love.
Mm.
It's in service of love. But it's been a really slow, long journey in terms of that coming into being, into fruition, into manifestation, whatever word, but in terms of the practical sort of lived day-to-day reality of that, it's been a long journey and still is continuing to, I feel it's like that, still that fog is still, I don't know what the future holds.
Well, it's so slow to come about, isn't it?
Yeah, but I can sense, it's like I've always sort of described myself as a big ship that takes a while to turn.
Sure.
So I can, it's like I can sense the fruit, the full blossoming, the full blooming, the full ripening of what that service looks like.
Mm.
But I'm still, I mean, I'm beyond the green shoots now for sure.
Yeah.
But I still feel like a baby in all of this in many ways, like in terms of the embodiment of what the true purpose of this soul is here for.
Right.
How about you? What did that look like for you? The doldrums, the coming out of those doldrums.
Did I yet?
Good question. This has been maybe a bit longer for you, generally speaking.
Well, I've had a different
journey.
In a sense, it looked like you know, we both shared the doldrums. We lived it together for a couple of years at least. And then little green shoots for a few years.
Yeah.
But still no real stability. No, let's say, the word that keeps coming to mind is surplus. There's no surplus. There was just sufficiency, but no surplus.
Yeah.
You know, in all these different levels, you know, inwardly, no, absolutely, you know, very, very soft, but lots
abundant,
of abundant, and transformations were happening, as you say, in this, even in the silence, just, but in terms of activity, in terms of
outward motion,
more outward, yeah. So I think we look slightly differently. That, in a sense, yeah, I leaned into the, let's say, the teaching earlier than you
did. For sure.
And then we were both kind of running sort of parallel for a while.
Yep.
And then I had to step out of it somehow. I felt the call, funnily enough, to sort of pull back out of it into actually, and I'm only just realizing this now, the last few years where I had pulled back into more introspection, became more my focus and, you know, sitting more, writing, introspection. I needed to go in again.
Cook.
And
different kind of cooking.
Explore and reevaluate, because I think part of it, again, I had this image of the wandering through the desert again, is that, you know, all you know when you come out of the, you know, the slavery, the tyrannical slavery and the structures that describe that. So much of that is echoes around, so to speak. Okay, let me get more specific about this. In my path, such as it was, could be characterized by three major strokes, which is to say, meditation was a big piece of it. Satsang was then the next big piece of it. And then transmission became, you know, grace, let's say, energetic, the grace of that, the kind of. But so the big part of my, you know, my seeking and my getting to understanding and recognition was meditation, satsang, and using teachings and practices to glean greater insight into the nature of what is. And that did the job. But after a while, after my awakening and sort of after the doldrums to some degree, when I started to meet with people, and helpfully, I trust and I see, but I started to feel that I needed to, even though how I was speaking and pointing wasn't untrue, but I wanted to discover my deeper recognition, understanding, and expression. What is it? What am I about? What's my voice? Like if I cleaned the decks, which I have of all the inherited.
Yeah, because you came teachings. In with quite a
heavy non-dual self-inquiry.
Buddhism, I mean, all sorts. You came in just generally with quite a body of knowledge.
Yeah, because it had helped me greatly. Yeah. But somehow I wanted to go. I mean, I remember weeks after I had woken up, you know, I was sitting with sitting in satsang with someone and I knew at that point I was awake, and I knew, and the phrase that came to mind was, oh, my silence is more eloquent than his teachings, than his pointings. And there wasn't to be, you know, presumptuous. And at the time I thought, God, I'm being a bit presumptuous. And I go, no, that's the truth. My silence here is just communicating so much that actually I don't want to hear any more teachings. I don't want to hear any more teachings now. I want to sit in this, this. And I think afterwards, I jumped into teaching early on, quite early on, within the year. Actually, I think I was
you were starting to did meet it with some people. I was, yeah.
And it was great. It was lovely. But then I got to a point. I went, oh, I need to get back into myself here, and I need to find out what the silence. I needed more of that. I needed more of that silence actually to talk to me.
Yeah.
Me. And that's been about 4 years now. Something like that. So in a sense, I feel like I'm coming out of it.
Yeah.
Finally.
Yeah, I see you're in a different, you're coming in. Well, we both are in different ways, very much so.
Yeah.
This last 6 months, this last year, but certainly the last 6 months very heavily, I think both of us are going through quite a transformation in our own ways.
Yeah,
they are obviously working together, but in quite different manners. And I guess it slightly feels like a sense of watch this space.
Yeah, and I don't know.
For myself.
Not
for anyone else, but just for myself. Like, let's see what happens.
Yeah.
Definitely feeling a new era, actually, is the word that comes right now.
Right.
A new era.
Right.
Don't know what that's going to look like.
Something's cooking.
Something's cooking. Has been.
And
but it's coming. It's the, again, we talked about the doldrums and then those green shoots. I feel like it's not that it's coming out of a doldrums phase, but that there are new green shoots of something yet to be born fully. Which is amazing to me because I had no idea.
What? That you would...
What I mean is like... quotes as a seeker that I really, really did buy into that. You recognize the self and you're done. Really bought into that.
Right.
Like really bought into that. And I think it's been like 8 years now.
Yeah.
I have still the vestiges of that belief can still catch me out occasionally.
Right. That's why I love words like ecstasis. God, I'm barely say it. Ecstasis.
I know. I got no hope. If you're struggling, there's just absolutely no hope.
Epictasis. Epictasis. The very real completion and rest and happiness in the divine nature.
Yes.
Alongside, and within that, the continued growth, evolution, transformation.
Yeah.
Both.
Both and.
One contained and occurring within the and ever deepening into that.
And that's real.
That's a thing. Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful thing.
It's the most beautiful
thing.
It's
so beautiful.
They call it the ever blossoming flower of being.
Yeah.
You know, it just continues to bloom, ever blooming.
How this embodiment of being human shows up and dances in the infinite.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, who knows what's next?
Yeah. There is a next. There's always a next.
Seems to be, yeah.
On the level we're talking about
here.
And yet, there we go, there's the paradox. There's the beautiful both and.
There's the ever-present, unchanging ground of all being.
Where next is irrelevant, and yet next is wholeheartedly embraced.
Yeah.
This beautiful life. Entirely perfect and complete.
Okay, I think that's a great place to start.
Thank you, everyone.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
Yeah, we really are touched very deeply by your comments and communications about listening to this podcast. We've had some really beautiful messages and feedback, and it's really, very touching to hear that.
Yeah. And also, don't forget if you know if someone listening wants to ask something or inquire into something, drop us a line. You can do it through the endofseeking.com or on Substack, whichever.
Yeah, I opened up, I don't know, a week ago, 2 weeks ago, a chat on Substack. So if you want to ask a question there, we can. I don't know. You can find us.
We might get to it.
Yes.
Might have some energy and we might get to, talk about something that's pertinent. Anyway, thanks everyone. See you next time.
Until next time.